Good evening. The death of a man who sang and played the guitar overshadows the news from Poland, Iran, and Washington tonight. Former Beatle John Lennon, who was 40, was shot and killed last night outside his luxury apartment in New York.
Have you ever been this crazy about any other entertainer?
No. And that's what's so amazing. We don't know why we're like this.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening. I apologize for my hoarse voice for the last, I would say like three episodes. I don't know. I've been snorting allergies. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but I'm snorting nothing other than allergies. And it feels like I have cement in one of my nostrils. So my voice has been hoarse for, I would say, like 3 weeks. So I apologize for the voice, but we're in it. But we had a great time at the Indy 500. I hope you enjoyed the Indianapolis extravaganza that I decided to do for like a full month. But now we're on to something different. And I appreciate you guys. And I love you. So this is the story of the life, the legend, the lore, and the tragedy of arguably one of the most famous and most accomplished musicians in rock and roll history, and his tragic death that shook the world and broke the world's hearts. This is the story of the murder, the life, the incredible career, the loves, the ups and downs of John Lennon. John Winston Lennon was born on October 9th, 1940, in Liverpool, during one of the most chaotic times in world's history. It was during World War II. During air raids, his mother gave birth to him. And his father was also mostly gone during this time because he was a merchant seaman. Due to the fact that his dad was, you know, often out of town, his mom, I don't think by any stretch of what I've read, which I don't think she was like drug addicted or really an absentee mom. I think she was just a single mom and was having a hard time raising a son on her own. And her sister called the authorities twice and was able to obtain custody of John Lennon. So he eventually was raised by his aunt Mimi. But he did bounce between his mom, his aunt, and sometimes his dad even. And he was close with his mom. I mean, who wouldn't be heartbroken when what comes next? Yes, he was raised by his aunt, but it still is his mom. And then sadly, before John was even 18 years old, his mom was struck by a vehicle when she was walking home and was killed. This sent him into, at least allegedly, he was drinking a ton, getting in bar fights or just fights in general. It made him angry, understandably. He lost his mom at a young age. And so that kind of started his trajectory into drug and alcohol abuse, which would mark a lot of his life. However, the loss of his mom would also connect him
and when
to
I found out later what had happened,
future
said,
Beatle Paul Captain McCartney,
did I see
who
him?
Lost his After mom News, at 14 years old.
Former Channel 7 reporter
For Orlando Lennon losing his mom sent him into a bit of a dark time.
I remember saying something like, I'm trying to put my
he started drinking
order,
heavily, getting in bar fights,
in a logical way, but the,
just fights
the,
in general, and
what's has really
it was
my,
very,
my
very
reason.
Hard
and
on him.
Also hear this story
I wouldn't say that I don't. I haven't researched Paul McCartney's situation enough and how John Lennon losing his mom affected him, but I believe John Lennon's really did affect him. And the absentee dad sort of situation, I think that that's what sort of started his struggles with drug and alcohol abuse.
Tell New York and tell the world. We gave the story to ABC.
So John Lennon Cosell meets Paul McCartney off-air during at a very formative age and a very formative time in their lives. They've both lost their moms. And this is a quote directly from BeatlesBible.com. And it's a quote from Paul McCartney. It said, "That became a very big bond between John and me because he lost his mom early too. We both had this emotional turmoil which we had to deal with. And being teenagers, we had to deal with it very quickly. We both understood that something had happened that you couldn't talk about, but we could laugh about it because each of us had gone through it. It wasn't okay for anyone else. We could both laugh at death, but only on the surface. John went through hell, but young people don't show grief. They'd rather not. Occasionally, once or twice in later years, it would hit in. We'd be sitting around and we'd have a cry together. Not often, but it was good.
Yeah, please.
Very sad. Paul McCartney, who is younger than John Lennon, was impressed by his guitar skills and songwriting ability. And soon after, by 1960, Lennon and McCartney had solidified a songwriting partnership. And then they added George Harrison on lead guitar, and later Ringo Starr on drums.
I think our society is run by insane people for insane objects and objectives. And I think that's what I sus when I was 16 and 12.
But besides the success of the Beatles starting to happen, John Lennon had personal success of sorts. He married Cynthia Powell, his pregnant girlfriend, in 1962. It was a very simple ceremony, and she would be very different from Yoko Ono, who we all know as his like most famous, you know, lover, wife, mother of one of his children. And yeah, it was just a very different thing. She was very structured, very traditional, very, very different from Yoko Ono. On April 8th, 1963, they gave birth to Charles Gillian Lennon. And in 1963, just a year afterwards, that's when the band really took off. That's when Beatlemania really happened.
The Beatles are great, Harvey Edmonds says so. Hey, the Beatles are great. Hey, the Beatles are great. They're great.
I love them. I don't care what anybody thinks. I love the Beatles for them, and I'll always love them. Even when I'm 105 and an old grandmother, I'll love them. And Paul McCartney, if you are listening, Adrian from Brooklyn loves you with all her heart. I love you, Paul, and please come to the window so I can just see you.
The closest thing possibly would be, I don't know. I'm not a huge Beatles fan, no offense, John Lennon. I don't know. Elvis? The Rolling Stones I would prefer over the Beatles, but I mean, women freaked out over Elvis, and women freaked out over the Beatles. And so, I mean, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, all of them, their careers just skyrocketed. And their manager, Brian Epstein, who helped them skyrocket to new heights, maybe got himself in too deep with the times. Brian Epstein basically, you know, held these guys up. He kept them together. He got them going. He made them stars. But the turning point for John Lennon, I believe personally, is when Brian Epstein died of a drug overdose pretty shortly into their major success. So they've become the biggest band in the entire world. Entire world. He's still married to Cynthia Powell, and he meets a woman by the name of Yoko Ono, who was also married at the time. And they form this friendship of sorts and decide to remain connected regardless of their marriages. My voice is very hoarse and I probably need to take a break.
Former Beatle John Lennon is dead. He was shot a short time ago outside his Manhattan apartment building.
The alleged killer is an unemployed security guard and printer who had lived in Hawaii. News of Lennon's death touched off a wave of shock and mourning around the world.
John Lennon, assassinated by a whack job who had a gun, stalked him for 3 days, shot him in a few seconds, and then for years left the world in mourning.
By the mid-1960s, all four Beatles were using marijuana and LSD. For John, LSD was transformative. It altered his worldview, feeling the psychedelic lyrics of songs like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and Tomorrow Never Knows, but it also pushed him into periods of disassociation. By 1968, during the recording of the White Album, the Beatles were showing serious cracks. John's drug use had intensified, particularly with heroin. His first marriage to Cynthia Powell was crumbling, and into that personal chaos came a mysterious figure who would transform his life. Yoko Ono. John had married Cynthia in 1962, largely because she was pregnant with his first son, which it makes me pretty sad because you'll see later how much it seems like he favors his son, Sean, which he had with Yoko Ono. And that's not to mean that Sean doesn't deserve love, but it makes me sad as I've listened to different podcasts, watched documentaries, read different articles that he really stepped it up when it came to his marriage to Yoko Ono and the birth of his son, Sean. His marriage to Cynthia, though, did deteriorate quickly as his celebrity grew. And his kind of like, he got, you know, real philosophical, and she was very straight-laced, it seems, which is probably why him and Yoko were a better match. So it's 1966. The Beatles are still huge. I mean, they're obviously still huge now. And John meets Japanese avant-garde artist Yoko Ono at a London art exhibit. She was unlike anybody he'd ever encountered, bold, intellectual, unapologetically herself. They had this artistic collaboration, famously were so into each other. Yoko became John's muse, his partner, and spiritual guide. Together, they explored experimental music, performance art, and radical political activism. To many Beatles fans, she was a disruptive influence, but to John, she was salvation. Their famous bed-ins for peace and anti-war efforts redefined Lennon not just as a musician, but as a global activist. Their love was all-consuming, sometimes to the point of isolation. John and Yoko were rarely apart, and their union created a divide between John and the other Beatles that widened over time. By 1970, the Beatles were no more. The breakup was a complex process involving creative differences, business conflicts, and personal estrangement. Lennon was the first to formally leave the group, though Paul was the first to announce it publicly. In his solo work, Lennon channeled the rawest parts of himself. His 1970 album, John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band, stripped away the glamour and myth. Songs like Mother, working class hero, and God were direct confrontations with his abandonment, pain, and cynicism. Later albums like Imagine and Mind Games continued to explore his ideals. Imagine, arguably his most, that's a beautiful song, arguably his most famous solo song, became an anthem for peace and humanism. But Lennon took a 5-year period where he did not make music at all. He stayed hunkered down in an apartment building in New York City called the Dakota.
The shooting happened at the Dakota apartment building minutes after John Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono left a recording session. When they got out of their limousine, a waiting gunman said Mr. Lennon crouched in military stance and squeezed off at least 4 shots from a .38 caliber pistol.
And within 2 minutes of the time I got there, they brought out Lennon. He was limp. He had blood coming outside of his mouth. He had his glasses on, and there were maybe 5 or 6 police officers holding him, carrying him, putting him in the back seat of a car. And very quickly, Yoko was with him.
Lennon was rushed to the nearest hospital just a few blocks away, but was dead on arrival. His body was taken to the morgue.
We have arrested Mark David Chapman of 55 South Kukui, K-U-K-U-I Street, Hawaii, for the homicide of John Lennon.
Chapman checked into this YMCA last Saturday, moved into a Midtown hotel the next day, was seen outside the Dakota over the weekend and yesterday. According to police, he managed to get Lennon to autograph a record album. During arraignment, Chapman was charged today with second-degree murder. He showed no reaction or emotion. The assistant district attorney said Chapman...
By the time John Lennon settled into the Dakota building in New York City with Yoko Ono in 1973, he was no longer the mop-top Beatle who sang about holding hands. He was now a revolutionary, a spiritual seeker, an exhausted father, and a drug user. A man deeply at war with the world, with the U.S. government, and often with himself. The Dakota, with its gothic spires and brooding mystery, became the fortress where Lennon hid from the chaos outside and the demons inside. The man who once electrified Shea Stadium was now quietly watching the world from the windows of his sprawling 7th-floor apartment, barefoot, baking bread, raising his son, and trying to hold on to his mind. Lennon and Ono moved into the Dakota in 1973, a year that marked a turning point in both of their lives. Located on the northwest corner of 72nd Street in Central Park West, the Dakota was an old-world, mysterious place full of famous people and ghost stories. It suited Lennon, a man who adored New York but increasingly wanted to hide from it. He said once, quote, "We all have Hitler in us, but we also have love and peace. So why not give peace a chance for once?" This paradox ran through everything in his life. The Dakota became a place where he could live that paradox. It was a retreat from the media frenzy, from the shadow of the Beatles, from the pressure to be John Lennon. And yet, for someone as restless and brilliant as Lennon, that retreat sometimes became a prison. One of the main reasons Lennon became reclusive in the Dakota was because he was quite literally under government surveillance. From 1971 through the mid-1970s, he fought a grueling legal battle to stay in the United States. The U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service had marked him for deportation, citing a 1968 conviction in London for marijuana possession. But everyone close to Lennon knew it wasn't about the pot. This was political. Lennon had aligned himself with radical leftist causes, anti-war protests, and vocal opposition to the Nixon administration. His 1972 anti-war performance at the One-to-One concert and associations with activists like Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and the Black Panthers painted a target on his back.
Clearly, it wasn't because of marijuana possession.
In London in 1968.
You're suddenly kicking out one of the if not the world's largest rock star from your country because of me. I mean, come on. That's just like, you might as well kick him out for guitar possession.
Yeah. It's what's insane is you're the world's largest star, basically. Yes. He had more power. And that's why Nixon freaked out.
Than the president.
Yeah, than the president. So he could sway the youth of America to go against Nixon. You know what I mean? Like, he could...
Yeah.
He could have changed the whole course of it.
Very intimidating for a president. I don't know if there's a comparable icon in today's world. I mean, just because there's so many of them now. Social media has created all these influencers. It's almost like everybody's famous, right? But in that particular period of time, like, I mean, John Lennon was as powerful as God.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a very famous quote that I think has been misconstrued. In 1966, John Lennon said that their band was more popular than Jesus. And this was very, very controversial. I think what he meant was... basically, I feel like he wasn't comfortable with the fame, basically. And also, he didn't believe in religions. And I don't know. It was a very controversial remark. It was made during an interview published in the London Evening Standard. And it drew significant backlash from the Bible Belt. They freaked out. They burnt the records doing, you know, religious...
Burn the records you may, but they still exist. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. The Beatles are still, you know, perhaps worldwide just as renowned as Jesus Christ. And at that moment, I do believe he wasn't lying.
But I think
globally, they might have been more popular than Jesus.
Well, and I think it was his not being able to accept the fame, sort of. So it's hard to explain how I feel about it, but
He
follows it up with, I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity.
I'm gonna rebuttal both of those statements with something Rick Rubin said. When it comes to the Beatles and that kind of mass hysteria, pandemonium, it's beyond human consciousness. Like, that is God.
I mean, literally women fainted. It's the only thing close, and I think I already said this earlier in the podcast, but the only thing close enough to it is Elvis.
But like, similar. The quote is, Rick Rubin said that the Beatles are proof of the existence of God. Because, I mean, like, that type of...
Yeah.
It was...
The frenzy.
The frenzy, money. Yeah. I mean, like, God wrote those records.
Well, it's actually... You know what? This is an interesting parallel. So, you know when... Okay, we've covered plenty of televangelists on this podcast. And you know when people start, like, fainting and, like, freaking out and, like, you know, speaking in tongues and whatever.
Yeah,
like,
they're drunk on the Holy Spirit. Overwhelmed by the Holy Spirit.
So, the God and Jesus comparison is... I mean...
I just think that, like, yeah, there's something supernatural about what the Beatles music and fame did upon the world. Like, I think that there was something cosmic, something from above that, like, helped write some of those records, and the Beatles were merely channeling it.
I agree with you. Actually, the first manager they had, last name Martin, who picked them up originally, said he wasn't even impressed with their demo tapes. Necessarily, he just liked their wit and their humor or whatever, but, like, it's just sort of like, I don't know, they just charmed their way into, I mean, and their music was good.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite. That's a controversial statement, but
I'm a big George Harrison fan. While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Oh, that's a great song. There's something supernatural about have you ever seen that video?
Come Together.
Oh, that's a great song.
I mean, there's some, you can't not be a Beatles fan. You don't have to like the whole catalog, but there's some Beatles.
There's, unless it's a, like, a camera trick, but there's that video where Prince is singing with George Harrison. They're doing While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And the guitar literally, like, I forget if it comes down from, there's some weird thing in this video that people cite as very supernatural.
The guitar starts crying itself. Gently.
Forever, you know.
Weeping.
Everybody's talking about now. I want peace now. We can get peace now if we want it now.
and the left wing.
But back to John Lennon really pissing off the government. The FBI opened a file on Lennon, and he was closely monitored. Documents later revealed that Lennon was viewed as a potential threat, especially because of his plan to mobilize young voters against Nixon in the 1972 re-election campaign. As Lennon put it, quote, "Our society is run by insane people for insane objectives. I think we're run by maniacs for maniacal ends."
Doesn't seem like much has changed in 60 years.
Yeah, and I can see why they would be a little bit triggered by his comments, though. So.
Where's our John Lennon today? Who's going to step up to the plate? I'm afraid not.
It's the Seven Deadly Sinners podcast.
My follower count's a little too low.
Seven Deadly Sinners is going to do it.
I'm not even as popular as John the Baptist. I'm not even as popular as Judas.
You're losing me.
I'm trying to think of like low-tier apostles.
What about
Luke, the apostle, not the Broderick?
It's amazing that I have two kind of religiously based podcasts and I don't know any of these things.
You're lucky you married me, because I went to Sunday school.
I did too, like a little bit. I was baptized Lutheran. Whatever, leave me alone.
By your grandma in your
No,
sleep.
She baptized me Catholic in my sleep when I was three. You got the wrong gal. Okay. So, as we know, the Nixon White House saw his presence in the U.S. as dangerous, not because of his drug history, but because of his influence, like you picked up on. Beetle with a political microphone was to them more dangerous than thousands of picket signs.
And it is.
Lennon's legal team, led by immigration attorney Leon Wildes, fought tooth and nail. They argued that the marijuana charge in Britain was minor and politically charged in itself. But what truly saved Lennon was a shift in the political tide. Nixon's resignation in 1974. In 1975, a U.S. court granted Lennon the right to stay, and by July 27, 1976, he was issued a green card. It's still just crazy to me that the most famous man basically in the world couldn't get a green card.
We don't want successful artists in our country unless they're Republican.
Unless they support the war.
Yeah.
So during this time, though, he was struggling with the immigration, very stressed out by it. Yoko handled a lot of like the legal battles and stuff. And he was in seclusion. He battled a heroin addiction, and allegedly Yoko Ono also did. That was during the late 60s and into the early 70s. They both used heroin, often as a response to the intense scrutiny and racism Yoko faced from the press and fans. Heroin was a reaction to what was going on around us, Lennon said. It was something to hide behind. While there's no hard evidence, Lennon used heroin consistently during his, quote, lost weekend period, or the Dakota years. The Dakota years are when he holed up into the apartment.
Yeah.
He was also caring for his young son, his firstborn or only son.
Sean,
yeah.
Sean Lennon, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey,
the thing that makes me really sad, though, for his prior kids with Cynthia Powell is it's like he really focused on Sean. And
better late than never.
True. It's just you
know,
sad.
Maybe those kids, because like I didn't even know they existed.
Julian
have lived more peaceful lives. Like one, Sean kind of like looks like,
yeah, he does,
John Lennon. And you know, you're born into that fame, so maybe they escaped it. Maybe that was actually better for him, you know?
Yeah, maybe. But there are strong suggestions that he remained vulnerable to drug use throughout his life, and that vulnerability increased during periods of depression and creative paralysis. So he didn't make music for 5 years. So maybe he stopped doing heroin.
Talk about writer's block.
Yeah.
Drugs will do that to you. They'll put you in it and they'll take you out.
Yeah. But the five-year span between 1975 and 1980, Lennon effectively disappeared from public life. He would go out maybe occasionally. But I think it was also hard for him to be, fans would just camp outside of his... Hence why he was eventually stalked and murdered. They would just hang out there to get the pattern of his life to figure out, okay, where is he going now? How do I follow him?
That kind of obsession, and to have thousands that obsessed with you. Man, you know, that's just not a peaceful living.
Yeah. But you would think New York City, like, people are used to seeing, but that just goes with the supernatural.
They were on another level. Yeah. They're just on another level. Like,
but like, where was Paul McCartney living at the time? For example, like, did he need to hole up and hide? Was he stalked?
Well, I think there's something that, like, when you're that famous, you can't hide, and hiding, quote unquote, is actually making the problem much worse because
people are more curious.
Well, they're. I didn't even think about that. They're more curious because you're not in the public eye. But two, like, once you're pinpointed, you're there. You're stuck. You're a sitting duck, right? And so, like, the isolation must really grow strong. I think if you're just kind of being normal Paul McCartney, you know, rather than hold up John Lennon, like, I don't know, maybe he's in Australia this month. Maybe he's in Britain. Maybe he's in LA. No one really knows. And you kind of, by naturally going about your own life, when you're that famous and successful and a mover and a shaker, you're all around. And there's some incognito camouflage to just being yourself and living your life and not stopping and hiding.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So those quiet years at the Dakota, there's no hard proof that John was still using heroin, because I believe he was using when the Beatles originally broke up, and I think it was hard for them to see their friend on hard drugs. Not that they all didn't do LSD and stuff, but I think that it was maybe hard.
Heroin's kind of another level.
Yeah, I mean, I've never...
From what I hear.
Yeah. I think it's... It also just appears more self-destructive. Like, it's... But
I think it is.
I mean, LSD sounds terrifying to me too, though. So.
Yeah, but people who do LSD, it's like they're like whacked out of their mind for a day. Like, most people who do LSD, I feel like they went on a drug trip, right? Then they come home from vacation and like they are whatever. You know, like they're not doing LSD every day.
Yeah.
It's not that kind of drug.
It still scares me. But there's no hard proof that during those quiet years that he was still using, but multiple friends later said that he was isolated, paranoid, and emotionally erratic. He was reading books on numerology, talking about spirits, locking himself in rooms. But then, and this is what people don't realize, like, the last year of his life actually was quite good. He had a sort of spiritual trip. In 1980, he takes a solo sailing trip to Bermuda. A freak storm hits. The crew all gets violently seasick, except one, John Lennon. Have to be pretty alert probably to. So he takes the wheel and rides out the storm alone, and something in him breaks, or maybe clicks.
So like, he sails through the Bermuda Triangle in a storm,
with probably no sailing experience. The crew all gets sick, like, and I think it gave him confidence.
That's how you find your lost soul.
Yeah,
sailing through the Bermuda Triangle. I'm writing a song about that.
Isn't it cool? I could cry.
I never knew that. That is awesome.
Yeah. And it changed him. It made him feel confident. He came back energized, inspired, and got back into music. Okay. For the first time in years, he picks up his guitar.
Oh, I relate to that.
He starts writing again. So it's 1980. John is 40. Sean is 5, his son. Obviously, the 5. And John is writing music again, recording again, laughing again. He and Yoko are working on Double Fantasy. Half the songs are his, half are hers. It's an artistic marriage. It's beautiful. Songs like Just Like Starting Over feel eerily prophetic, like a man pressing reset, like he knows something is coming. He gives interviews again. He walks around New York. He tells reporters, I feel like I've been reborn. I finally understand what it means to be at peace. But peace had a price, though. Because while John is trying to be a father, a husband, a man with one last album to give, someone was watching. This piece of shit stalker. And this is where we meet the killer. A man with a Bible in one hand and a gun in the other. A man who believed he was destined to murder. A man who stood outside the Dakota with John Lennon's autograph and returned hours later to destroy him. December 8th, 1980. The air was cold in Manhattan. Manhattan was glittering with Christmas lights. John Lennon had just wrapped up a photo shoot with Annie Leibovitz, that famous one of them in bed. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're cuddling naked.
Yeah.
Bird's eye view.
Yeah. He had spent the day giving interviews, recording music. He felt like he had a really good session that day. He held his son Sean that morning, told him he loved him, told him he'd be home soon. He stepped out of the Dakota around 5 p.m. And on the sidewalk, waiting like a fan, was Mark David Chapman. Let's talk about Mark David Chapman for a second, because his story is textbook fantasism meets pure festering delusion. He was born in Texas, raised in Georgia, deeply religious, deeply unstable. As a teenager, he was obsessed with the Beatles. Then, like a switch flipped, he turned on them, especially John. Because John Lennon said in 1966 that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus. And for someone like Chapman, who was already teetering on the edge of psychosis, that was unforgivable. He started reading The Catcher in the Rye like it was scripture. He believed he was Holden Caulfield, that he had a mission to kill phonies. And somehow in his twisted mind, John Lennon was the biggest phony of all. Now listen, he also did an interview at a certain point that said he basically wanted to be famous. And he thought by killing John Lennon, the most famous man, that would give him fame.
Well, I'm glad he didn't get it, because I couldn't have told you his name prior to you saying it. Also, I couldn't.
Why is it always three names too? You know, like
John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Don't give your kid three names. They might be an assassin. But I can't believe it happened in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it made it into the 80s, it's like, wow, I just always kind of assumed it was earlier.
One of the sources for this episode, and I'll list the other ones, is a documentary that's on Apple TV. And it's the first time that, like, they call him his concierge. And then this woman who had just interviewed him that day, I believe, she was young. It was like her dream to interview him. She'd flown into New York to interview him before he goes into the studio. It's talking to all these people for the first time. The concierge had never spoken until, and I think this documentary is from like 2023. And they're just so utterly heartbroken. And they remember, I'm trying to think of the other guy. He wasn't the concierge. It might've just been the doorman or security detail. That guy can barely even hold it together. And it looks like he takes like a sip of scotch or something, like trying to get through talking about it. And they remember seeing that guy, thinking there's this sort of roly-poly. I encourage you guys to watch it. It's really well done and really sad. Like kind of guy that just like creeped him out.
So the doorman security kind of just feels responsible that he didn't stop it.
Yeah, but they felt weird about this guy, and they remember him asking like for an autograph or for like real weird specific details, and being like kind of creepily upbeat. Then he shows up later.
Yeah.
It's creepy. So that afternoon, Chapman waited outside the Dakota. John was leaving for the studio with Yoko when Chapman stepped forward holding a record, Double Fantasy. John looked at him, smiled, and signed it. There's a photo, a haunting one, taken by another fan just moments after. John, pen in hand, Chapman standing beside him, smiling like he hadn't already decided what he was going to do.
Ghostly.
Yeah. Then it's just before 11 p.m. John and Yoko return from the studio. The limo pulls up. They get out. They're just steps from the lobby when the Chapman guy calls out, "Mr. Lennon." John turns. Chapman fires five shots. Four hit John in the back and shoulder. One misses. John stumbles up the steps, blood's everywhere. He says, "I've been shot," and then he collapses. Yoko screams. The doorman tackles Chapman, who doesn't run, doesn't struggle. He pulls out a copy of Catcher in the Rye and sits on the curb, calmly reading. Which leads me to believe he wanted to be caught because he wanted to be famous for it.
What a creep. What a weirdo.
Yeah, he didn't even try to escape because for him, the murder was like a performance.
Yeah. Well, it was. It was his stage.
John Lennon was rushed to Roosevelt Hospital. He had no pulse. They tried to keep him alive. They actually, even in this documentary, interviewed the ER nurses and the ER surgeon doctor and whatever. For 45 minutes, they kept trying to pump his heart.
Can you imagine? Because it's like, it says the closest you're going to get in the modern age to Jesus Christ rolling in on a stretcher, and it's John Lennon.
Oh, yeah. That was what was crazy, too, is that they, I forget which person it was, didn't realize until like they like saw like a little bit more of his face and they're like, it's John Lennon. They tried, the doctor said, for 45 minutes to like manually like get his heart going.
Yeah.
And then they eventually had to give up. The ER nurses had to go tell, they like got on their knees and told, it's very sad, Yoko Ono.
It's so tragic. Absolutely tragic.
It's so senseless.
But what I think is kind of beautiful about this, now hearing the story, like, you know, I kind of knew about his depression, but like not that it lasted so long. And I definitely didn't know that he sailed through the Bermuda Triangle and came out of it. So there's something for me. What a beautiful day. That famous photo happened the day he was murdered. I'd kind of heard that before, but like he was at peace and he held his son and got to tell him goodbye. At least he wasn't, you know, in the depths of the despair when this happened.
But that's also why it's like kind of sad that this fucking idiot snuffed out the brightness in someone that had just gotten their brightness back.
Yeah, but I think it's shining through in so many ways.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, New York lost its breath that day. The world stopped. The whole world lost its breath. Fans gathered outside the Dakota all night, lighting candles, crying, screaming, praying. I just can't even imagine. Like, we weren't born yet, so I don't.
I think it's a bigger deal than a president being assassinated, I would imagine.
Well, clearly he was threatening the president, the president felt threatened by him. But radio stations were playing Imagine on loop. People stood in the streets, stunned and shattered. And that is the tragic murder. Because I was going to talk more about Mark David Chapman, but I don't want to give him.
He doesn't deserve it.
Yeah. He doesn't deserve it. I don't want to talk about the murderer. It was better to talk about John Lennon's life.
I would like to argue that John Lennon's assassination further propelled their popularity and his music to stay in the ethos of America and the world for longer.
And Imagine is such a beautiful song.
And cemented his legend and maybe in a very prophetic way, his early death. There's something about like only the good die young type of thing. Like
he was
the
40.
27 club. Mm-hmm. Well, just that like,
I mean, 40 is still
very
young.
If you're going to be an absolute legend, it's kind of like you gotta, I don't know. I hope that what I'm saying is true, that his early death in turn kind of breathed new life and more life into their music and kept it popular for longer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe Lennon's spirit can not have died in vain because of that.
I didn't realize this. Here Today is a song McCartney wrote, and this song is a tribute to Lennon, reflecting on their shared experiences and memories, both losing their moms and their teens. It says he can barely talk about it, besides maybe just in music. Well,
it makes me emotional.
Yeah, well, that is the tragic murder of John Lennon. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I hope you enjoyed it. I apologize again for my hoarse voice. I keep snorting allergies. And not much I can do about it at this point.
Spring is here.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. And I will see you next week.